First of all, I want to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's a pleasure to talk here. I will talk a little bit of our work that we are doing in Grenoble, the University of Grenoble. I'm employed by the CNRS. And this work is partly financed by the European Research Council. And I will cover different aspects that that is done in the group. And this is the group. So there's this work done together with Alexandre Nicolas, who just finished his thesis, Elisabeth Agorizes, who's working on mean field models, Jean-Louis Barra, who's the head of the ERC project, Eric Pertin, who's also working on the mean field descriptions, Francesco Puisi, who's doing microscopic simulations, and then also Ezequiel Ferrero, who's doing mesoscopic models. And Ezequiel, Elisabeth, and Jean-Louis are here as well, so you can discuss with them as well. So, now. In earlier talks, people were discussing about whether details matter or not. And I'm a physicist, and I have a physicist point of view. And for me, I would like to say that metallic glasses, polymer glasses, gels, and foams are all the same. Of course, they are not. in appearance, they are very different. So, but I want to concentrate on their common features. So what are the common features of these materials? They are disordered on the level of particles. And when you shear them, they behave solid-like underneath the force, of given force, critical force, and above a critical force, they start to flow. So there's this yielding transition. And all of these materials have something in common when you force them, is that their response is very heterogeneous, so you will have some local rearrangements that occur. So this idea of localized shear transformation is already a little bit old. It was proposed by Ali Agon, and the similarity between glasses and foams, the analogy to think about the systems is also very old. It was first proposed by Bragg in the crystalline material systems, where he compared this with monodispersed bubble rafts. So, I want to set the vocabulary as well, so I will talk about different scales. Always when I talk about microscale, I mean on the particle level. This can be atoms, this can be bubbles, this can be different sizes, right? So when I talk about the macroscale, I talk about observables that are averaged over the whole system size. And then I will also talk about the mesoscale, and the mesoscale for me will be some tenths of particles, and it will be the size of a typical rearrangement. Now I'm coming to the response to the steady shear. So here we see some microscopic realizations of this localized event. So this is a work done by, this one particularly is done by Anton Guy et al, but there are similar works by Maloney and Lemaitre that show that this response is very much localized. And this is an experiment, it doesn't look like, but this is a colloidal experiment by Peter Schall, who sees also this experimental verification of this localized events. And on the macroscopic scale, what people look at, for example, is the stress versus strain curve, and you see that you have something that looks pretty much like elastic response, and then you have a yielding, and you can see this in hard materials, but also in gels, for example. So when talking about soft materials, first of all, I think pretty much everybody, maybe 97%, is agreeing on this picture of this localized events in this room. And one of the important questions is, how can we connect what is happening on the microscale with what we see on the macroscale? So many people are working on this. And I put the bridge here, and it's a long bridge because it's very difficult. So it's maybe even not possible to write down the equation and do a proper coarse graining to derive macroscopic equation from the microscopic dynamics. It's a very difficult problem. So when talking about real soft material, there is another curve which is often displayed, which is the rheological curve. And this is concerned with the steady state of the system. So you shear it until it reaches steady state. So, and there are two scenarios possible. So you have here the flow transition. If your shear rate equals zero, it doesn't flow. If you increase the shear rate, it starts to flow. And the first scenario is that you have a continuous transition to flow. And this is associated with a phenomenological law, which is the Herschel-Berkeley law, which is given here with a finite yield stress and some power law behavior in the shear rate. But there's also a second scenario possible, which is a discontinuous transition, where you see that if, when you increase the shear rate, the medium in the steady state is not responding homogeneously, but there are shear bands forming up to a critical value of the shear rate. And this is explained, for example, here by Cousseau et al. And what you see is instead of having a Herschel-Berkeley law, you will have a plateau here, and you will start above a critical shear rate to have a power law. Okay, so the question, many people here already asked the question, what are the dynamics close to the transition? So in this continuous transition scenario. But I also want to ask another question, that is, what is the control parameter that takes me from a system which is displaying homogeneous flow to a system which is showing shear bands? Okay. These are experiments. This is another motivation to look at these questions. Where you see that within the same systems, when you change, for example, emulsions and you make them attractive for depletion, you will have, in the non-heterogeneous case, typical Herschel-Berkeley curve, whereas in the adhesive case, you will have this plateau. This is difficult to distinguish, I agree. So what you really need to do to distinguish this type of dynamics is to look at spatial flow. And you see that, for example, in this emulsion experiment, they have here the shear band that appear. Okay, so far to the introduction. Now I will come to the model that I want to study. And this model is very much inspired by what Damien was showing the other day. They were the first to propose such a type of model within this context. And the aim is to have a very, very simplistic lattice model with minimal ingredients. Might not be realistic, but it gives a tool at hand to test several physical concepts. So the minimal ingredients are plastic events and elastic stress redistribution. We will consider athermal systems, so now I'm already restraining myself rather to more macroscopic systems like foams or emulsions or colloids. Then I consider here periodic boundary conditions, simple shear, because then you can just look at the scalar stress, it's easier, and overdamped dynamics, so I will not include inertia. And this first works by Vandenbroek and Roux were done in the quasi-static limit, so this is an extremal model. I want to study the rheology, so this means I need also to introduce time dependence of the equation. And I just wanted to point out that there are many people now more and more working on this type of models, and it can give a good insight what is happening on a more cross-ring scale. Next. So. What we will put into the model to describe the elastic interaction. This was shown already by Itamar Papogacchia earlier. For the simple shear case, you can have a propagator that has this form for the stress. And it's depicted here. So it has this typical quadrupolar form that we saw already several times. And this is simulations. And when you look at the average displacement field, non-affine displacement field, and Lennard-Jones simulations, you can really reproduce this. This is a very beautiful work, which is very recent. And so the model that we want to build up is composed of first elastic parts. So when I start to shear, the system will just increase elastically its stress up to the appearance of the first yield events. And these yield events are described by a convolution of this elastic kernel with a plastic field. And then, of course, I need to introduce also some yield criterion. So the yield criterion tells me this field N, this we call activity field, it can be either 0 or 1, tells me whether locally I'm active or not. So I need to write down some dynamics for this activity. And typically what we write down is that we have that the local stress, when the local stress exceeds the threshold, then it will yield. So 0 goes to 1 with some rule, some stochastic rule. And we also have relaxation to the elastic state again, so it goes from 1 to 0 with another stochastic rule. I don't specify these rules here because they can be different, and I will go into this discussion when I talk about the athermal idea of modeling the systems. Okay, this was introduced first by Guillemette Picard. Okay, go further. So, when you go to very low shear rates, you see that in these models you can reproduce displacement fields which look not so different from what you can observe in simulations, for example. So you can have here the correlations between events that lead to large slip events, for example. Whereas at large shear rate, you will see something which is very homogeneous on average. Okay. This is now a picture of the cumulated activity. You can imagine this when you deform a ruler, then you can see where the cracks appear. So this is the equivalent to that. And you see that this is very heterogeneous. And we believe that there is a dynamical phase transition when the shear rate goes to zero. Similar as in the depinning scenario, if you don't control gamma dot, but you control the stress, you arrive at the yield stress here. This is apparently similar to the glass transition. Why do I compare it to that? Because I will use some tools which are borrowed from this community. And the difference is that here the length scales can really reach macroscopic size. One example is here, this experimental paper, but I know that you all have seen this in your simulations or experiments. So the tool that I borrowed to describe correlated events in the finite shear rate regime are four-point correlations. So the problem, Mark Robbins already pointed that out, when you have at finite shear rates, avalanches are not well-defined anymore. So you have events that are occurring everywhere in the system with a given correlation length, and avalanches between each other also can be correlated. So this is a tool to capture the probability of having an activation somewhere, given that at some earlier point, some elsewhere in the system, there was an activation before. So then you don't care whether they are connected or not, and you can, for example, look at this G4 at the most correlated time. So this is the volume that you get, the correlated volume, and the stress fluctuations. And you can also integrate over this object and look at this as a function of time, and you will get that for decreasing shear rate, you get longer and longer time scales for the correlations. And the peak, the height of the peak, is an indication for a length scale, and you will get also longer and longer length scales. So this is a signature for a critical point. We did some finite size scaling analysis on this, but I don't want to talk here so much about quantitative results, but more qualitative results. So I will rather go now to the other question, which is, what is the control parameter to go one from one to the other, right? From the homogeneous flow with the continuous transition that I just showed you, to a system where you have shear bends in the steady state. And in the very same model, if you define your yielding, so this is now the local stress as a function of time, you hit a local yield stress here, and you will yield with a certain time. So there's a duration of a localized flow event. And within this framework, we find if this time is very long, you find that within the mean field description of this model, you get a minimum in the flow curve. So this indicates that there is an instability, because by increasing the shear rate, you get a decrease of the stress. This must be unstable. And so you will expect that there is localized flow. And indeed, when you do the simulations, you find that at small shear rate and large restructuring time, this means large healing time locally, you will have shear bends. And you can study this shear bend as a function of the shear rate, and you see that if you go to larger and larger shear rate, it occupies more and more parts of the system. So at a critical shear rate, you will reach the system size. This is where the system flow becomes homogeneous again. Okay, this seems to be quite consistent. We were not the first to think about this in these terms. There was a paper by Cousseau and Ovales who was pushing also forward the idea of having a time which is responsible to obtain a non-monotonic flow curve for the minimum. And so we are exactly in line with this thinking. But I should say that there could also be other origins, which is, for example, flow concentration coupling, shear weakening. Also, in the soft glass rheology, you can have a coupling of the effective temperature, which I don't go into. But there are different ways how you can get this shear bend phenomenon. And I just want to say that we believe that the shear weakening, this is local shear weakening, is similar to our idea. That means that you have locally broken something, and next time it will be easier to break it again. So this is also in the same spirit that you think there is a long healing time that leads to shear bend formation. Going to the next. Now I will come to the main part of the talk, which is the question of thermal dynamics. And this is a little bit dangerous, and so be nice. So what we propose for the thermal dynamics in the yielding dynamics is that you will have a duration of a plastic event. So there, to model this, there should be only two ingredients. There should be the fact that your system is structurally disordered, so you have a distribution of yield stresses, and you have a certain duration of a plastic event, so a certain dissipative time. And the interplay between the drive and this duration of the event will then lead to your nonlinear flow curve. So these are simulations done by Alexandre Nicolas, and he finds a flow curve with an exponent of 0.56, which has been found a lot in the literature, 0.5 in experiments and in theory, but I'm not sure. I talked to Mark Robbins, he's telling me this is only a size, finite size effect, so I wouldn't put my hand into the fire for this exponent. So this, by the way, would be the beta exponent in Mathieu's talk, 1 over, so this is 1 over beta, right? Okay. So then the question is, now if we want to derive mean field descriptions, the question that I want to ask is, are thermal dynamics effectively thermal? And it's very tentative to think, well, you have an energy landscape, and then what happens if you have your events here and there, and they have a long-range interaction, you have fluctuations that occur, mechanical noise. You could think all these fluctuations are the same. Temperature and mechanical fluctuations are all equivalent. So then you would think mechanical noise fluctuation should help you also to overcome barriers, and you would write an Arrhenius law with an effective temperature here. We don't believe in this picture. Why? First of all, one argument that you can give is when you have a rearrangement somewhere, that means that elsewhere there is a persistent change of the boundary conditions. It's not like a random kick that is done in a temperature situation, right? So mechanical noise fluctuations are persistent. And then within the model that I just showed you, which is the mesoscopic model, you can calculate the escape time as a function of the yield energy, and you find that it's power law instead of exponential, which means that it's much easier to escape. So which means that the analogy would be flawed. Another picture that you can, more mathematically, you can motivate it like this. So you have your state within the potential energy landscape picture, and you will have fluctuations in the potential due to the real temperature, ambient temperature. And you can ask the question, what does the mechanical noise do? So if you shear the system, your potential will be tilted, and you can write down the dynamics for the strain, which is given here, it's an overdone dynamics. Here's the derivative of the tilted potential, and you have the thermal noise. Now, how do you get to the plastic mechanical noise? Well, you can write down the corresponding equation for the strain, which will be governed by the increase to the shear rate and the fluctuation in the strain. What this means, instead of having additional fluctuation within the energy well, you have fluctuation in the tilting of the potential, which is very different with respect to thermal fluctuations, right? Okay, so this is why we believe if you want to write down a mean field model, it's another question whether this is this makes sense at all or not. But if you want to write down a mean field model, this mean field model should take into account this this feature that temperature fluctuations are different from mechanical fluctuations. So, and there is a model. It's called the Ebro-Lecuy model. It has been a little bit forgotten. Not many people study this equation. And so what it describes is the exact same scenario that I showed you before, is that you look at the probability distribution of stresses, which is changed due to the shear rate here. So this is the gradient term. Then this term describes you some rate to break when you're above sigma c. This is your local yield criterion. And then this is the rate with which you go here to zero. This could be another value as well. And the effect of the elastic propagator goes into this term, which is a noise term, right? It's a diffusion term on the stress. And so here, when you look at this picture, and I will just show as well the rate. So the rate here is a typical time over which you yield when you're above sigma c. And so the picture here would be that you have a random walk on a flat energy surface instead of having a random walk on a potential. Okay? And so this equation like this is quite boring, and it doesn't give any interesting physics. The interesting physics comes in when you say that this diffusion coefficient should be coupled to the activity. This is where this equation becomes nonlinear in P and difficult to solve as well, more difficult to solve at least. But this is where you get the feature that depending on this coupling strength, you can have either a Newtonian regime, or when the coupling strength is small, you have a yield stress, and you have this Herschel-Barclay form. And you can analytically solve this model, and you get an exponent which is 1/2. So maybe you think you haven't seen this in the conference yet, but actually you did. You saw a spatial version of this, which is the CAP model derived by Bouquet et al., Lederach Bouquet. And this was used to fit all the data in the talk of Ken Cameron. So if you were convinced by what Ken was showing you, you should also be convinced by these equations for the simple shear. Okay. So there are many assumptions in the Évreux-Lecoeur model. One being very strong, that is the color of the noise, the mechanical noise, being white noise. We didn't believe this at first, and then we did microscopic simulation of Leonard Jones systems here, and actually we see that if you look at the stress diffusion, here's the mean square displacement of the stress diffusion, you see that it's linear in T, so it seems to be, at least in the system, a good approximation. Then another thing, so I didn't insist on that too much, but if you look in the equation, we put here in the equation a single yield stress. So this is all the same for all the sites. And of course, you would expect that due to disorder, this should be a distributed value. And indeed, when you do simulations and you measure the yield stress, I can explain more how we do this, you find that there's a distribution of these yield stresses. So one question, one important question is whether the exponent that you get from the Évreux-Lecoeur is robust with respect to this distribution. And it's an important question because in the SGR model, for example, it's the very form of this distribution that gives you the Herschel-Barclay law. So Elisabeth Agoritsas is doing this calculation, and she studies the robustness of this exponent with respect to the yield stress distribution. And it turns out that the equations are still analytically solvable. And for reasonable distribution that are not power law, but rather exponential decay, etc., we get a change of the Herschel-Barclay law, but only in the coefficient and the yield stress, whereas the exponent is robust. If you want to know more about this, there's a poster as well. So I come to the conclusions. So I wanted to insist that this mesoscopic modeling, even though it might seem unrealistic, is a very useful tool to think about and test physical concepts. And I showed you some examples on dynamical heterogeneities and phase separation. And you can even use them to fit experiments. I didn't show this here, but you can push it further and get real comparison to experiments. Also, they give a tool, since they are simple enough, they give a tool to derive analytical solvable mean field equations. But I also want to insist that afterwards, you need to test the assumptions and results on experiments and on simulations, because there's no solid derivation of this equation. So you really need to go back and see whether your toy model works in the right way. Okay, another word I wanted to say about equilibrium concepts. So I think one should be very careful when you generalize non-equilibrium when you generalize equilibrium concepts to non-equilibrium systems. For example, in this case, I showed you that we believe that athermal yielding is very different from the in nature from the thermal yielding. Sorry. So I come to the end. The outlook. So what we want to study in future is to see what are the relevant features in the microscopic simulations. For example, we saw that the yield stress distribution doesn't seem so important, but there will be other features that are. And to see how we can relate parameters in the phenomenological models to microscopic dynamics. For example, this restructuring time. Do we know what potential we need to put into microscopic simulations to get a large restructure in time that gives you shear bending? And then also the question, more on a mean field level, how can we push further the modeling to go to the thermal material in a low temperature regime, for example, where you will have competition between thermal and mechanical noise. And the first attempt to generalize the equations is given on the post-server Ezekiel. Just last thing, I have a little announcement. I don't have three positions, but one. Available in 2015. This is on failure precursors in soft matter, and it's in collaboration with our experimental partner in Montpellier. Thank you very much.
Can you connect for me the Abramovitz equations to the soft glassy rheology? Just
yes.
I've not looked at this for a while.
Of course. So if you wanted to write down a model that reproduces the soft glassy rheology, mm-hmm. you would need to have also a repulse, a recoil force. So you need a diffusion mm-hmm. within a potential. So there should be an additional term that mimics the potential.
That's it? And then the form of the sigma minus sigma c, whether if the sigma c
yes,
is distributed
exactly.
exponentially or not.
Exactly. If you want to write down SGR the traditional way, you won't put the diffusion plus the potential, but you directly write down the coarse grain thing with the Arrhenius mm-hmm, mm-hmm. term,
but,
right?
But these two should effectively give me
yes.
give me that. And so then, is the SGR temperature like the fluctuations of the stress in like
here? No.
So you said the stress fluctuations look white noise like.
Yes.
But that.
But this is not sufficient because it depends. So this is the picture that I show you here. You have white noise, mm-hmm. but what we believe it's fluctuations on the tilting of the potential. It's not adding to the noise that is within the potential. In athermal situations as well, I would say.
Okay.
Yes?
Yes.
So it's Matthias here. I want to better understand how you corroborate with your molecular dynamics that you're doing something sensible. Maybe you can show that. I didn't understand what you actually measure. So you shear the system?
You mean
at what
the
shear
diffusion?
Rate? Yeah.
Okay. Yes, this is a sheared system, and what you measure, we wanted to depict exactly the same thing like the EPRO-LECU or the mesoscopic model does. That is, we divide boxes, we measure already the typical size of the events, then we divide boxes in our system that have the same size as the size of events. And within the size, we measure stress fluctuations, right?
So you have a solid, and you shear it at what rate? Is that you shear the hell out of it, or is it close to any transition?
It is, so it's highly gemmed, and it's sheared slowly. At a very
so you would be close to a transition?
Yeah, close to the transition. Yeah. This is already where you should see avalanches and all. I could look up the exact share rate. I don't know it here. But.
Can I imagine a measurement for that?
A what?
Can I measure that function?
Measure that function?
Can I devise an experiment to measure that?
So I know that there are emulsion experiments by Weeks et al., and they can measure the stresses. Okay. So they have a way from the geometrical form of their emulsion bubbles to get the stresses. So they should be able to, but this is tedious, of course, but they could measure this.
Yeah. And you say
if they do it at random, as you say.
Yeah.
And you argue if that turns out to be linear, like diffusive, then you're in business.
Oh, no, you could generalize. So I'm just saying you need to test, right? We put something, so no, not we, but Ebro-Lecu, they put this term without knowing. So we even thought probably this is wrong. Then you go and measure, and you could very well here have, instead of white noise, another colored noise, right? This is just to say, once you write down the equation, you get the exponent, you think, well, maybe this is describing something. You go back to the initial assumptions and you verify. And maybe there are other assumptions within this. For example, a very important one, which is wrong and which should change things, is that here in the Ebro-Lecu model, you are releasing the stress to a stress value of zero. This is not true. And this is something that changes your flow curve. I don't know about the exponent because it's difficult to calculate things in this limit, but
I'm over here.
Yeah.
Really beautiful talk. I had a comment and then a question. And so the comment that I would make is that you said that, you know, areas that have already broken are easier to break, and that's the basic physical origin of the shear banding that you see in your model. And you commented, which I think is, I agree with, that actually that shows up in Karin's model with damage. Mm-hmm. But actually that's exactly the same feature that shows up in Suzanne Fielding's recent paper in SGR and mm-hmm. the fluidity models and actually all the STZ models as well. And so then the comment would simply be that I think that the way to distinguish between models, besides your very well taken point that you should try to measure things in actual experiments and simulations, is to also look at the shape of the shear bands, how they change as a function of quench rate and not just strain rate. Lots of, you know, in other words, what it means is I think we're converging to an idea, but then you have to test it very carefully. So that's the comment. And then the question is, I was really sort of struck by the fact that, you know, you showed that the mechanical fluctuations are persistent in the way. And so this is probably a dumb question, but
persistent. They are diffusive.
You had on a slide that you sort of said that the mechanical fluctuations are
persistent. I see what you mean. So once you do something there, all the changes are permanent, right?
Yeah, you said they're sort of irreversible.
Yes,
right.
That's what everybody says, right?
I totally agree. And I was just wondering, I may have misunderstood, but I also, given that the fact that the sort of fluctuations that you see from stress fluctuations are so different from the ones that you see thermally, I was wondering if you could map it on to some of these models for active particles that have a persistence time to their motion and are...
So it's not persistent in sense of persistent time, of course, yeah. During the event, since everything is instantaneous, you're right, there's a persistent. And this is something we do with Ezequiel Ferrero. You can see when you study this without shear, you see during this time that there are compressed exponentials in the structural relaxation. Mm-hmm. So it is important and there is some persistence. But I don't think that's the same thing like an active matter.
Well, I agree. It can't be the same thing exactly.
It's not...
But I was just wondering if there might be an interesting analogy to be made that the noise structure, you know, is it a feature of the noise structure being different? And could you map that onto a different set of problems that people can study very easily?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, a nice presentation.
Thank you.
In your calculation, can you actually predict the stress strain curve, see the fluctuation in the curve?
Whether we get the, so...
Yes.
when we do the mesoscopic model, of course, we get all the phenomenology that we saw before with the avalanche dynamics. So you can see the elastic charging, avalanches, so you get fluctuations with low shear rates. Yes, you do, in the steady state, for example. In the mean field, of course, you don't, because you're only interested in the mean values.
And you can do it at different strain rate?
You can, in the mesoscopic model, this is all at different strain rates. This is the point of this talk is really to see how the stress is changing with shear rate or strain rate.
Thank you.
Two more questions. Yes. One over there.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about the following. You are able to investigate one shear bend, but in experiments very often you have a pattern of shear bends. Mm-hmm. And pattern of shear bends involve a different scaling, specifically spaces between bends.
You're working in?
Second?
You're working in metallic glasses?
For example, we observe pattern of shear bend in granular materials. We observe pattern of shear bend in amorphous materials. Mm-hmm. And the interesting, a new, let's say, phenomena is a scaling, mm-hmm. which determines the space between shear bends.
So I'm not sure. So, okay, in granular material, I'm not a specialist in granular material.
I will show you.
But there's a difference between, so there's a confusion of what people call shear bends, right? So what I showed before, where you have at very low shear rates, dynamical heterogeneities, you can have also correlated events that go through all the system size, which you could call also a shear bend. And I think in all the, so what I believe is when you have a very hard system, this prepares a fracture. So this is what you would see, and there you see all these fractures. So this was what I showed, the dynamical structure factor or the G4 calculation were done for this, and there you see a fractal of this. Whereas if you go to the long steady state limit, I'm more thinking of foams and things like this that you can shear during a long time. At least in the foam systems or emulsion systems, typically you see just one shear bend that goes through the hole. Initially you see different things, of course, but in granular I'm not sure how this looks like.
Okay, Charles, make it quick.
Okay. If I'm not mistaken, you had a slide in the beginning that showed that that rate weakening is necessary for shear banding, if I'm correct.
Not necessary. Possible.
Yeah, this is something that I respectfully disagree with, because... Yeah.
I just say it's one of the phenomenon. It's not necessary.
Yeah. What I think is that shear band...
If you have this, that you get shear bands.
What? But still, this is something I'm a little bit dubious about, because I think shear banding is supposed to be associated with some kind of spatial heterogeneity and not with some global structure, and rate weakening is more or less global.
What kind of shear bends are you talking about again?
Because
I also showed you the dynamical heterogeneities. We do have them. But then you can go to another regime where, for example, in foams, you just have one band that is flowing during a long, long, long time, and it's not changing position because it's fixed to the wall. And I think then you are closer to this description.
So you're referring to what you call dynamical heterogeneities?
Here, the shear bands, no. These shear bands are permanent shear bands, and they are not dynamical heterogeneities. So if you see the picture here, if you do the simulations, where do I have this? Mm-hmm. When you go to the infinite system size limit, this shear bend will be just stuck there. It's spontaneously appeared. It's stuck there, and it stays there forever.
Right, and it is actually this kind of shear bend which, in my mind, has close to nothing to do with rate weakening behavior. I think it has to do with some spatial heterogeneity of how you prepare the material instead of the global part.
You're working in hard amorphous systems, don't you?
Okay.
I think in hard amorphous system it's very different than from soft soft materials.
Let's continue this discussion at lunch. We are going to now prepare for Vincenzo Vitelli's talk.
Thank you.
Kirsten?